Today's story is about globalization, which is partly about exploration, the expansion of the economy, but globalization is even more about how the desire for spices and other luxury items literally connects the entire globe, how plants and animals and diseases are for the first time in human history transported across continents, and not just from Americas to Europe, but from Asia, from Africa, and from Europe everywhere. And this globalization, I will venture to say, is probably the most important event in human history since the discovery of agriculture. But let's backtrack just a little bit. How did this all start? Let's go to mid-15th century Venice, when the Venetians had pretty much monopolized the spice trade. They picked up these spices and luxury goods like silk, gold, drugs, dyestuffs in the Eastern Mediterranean, and then they brought them to the rest of Europe. Now keep in mind that these goods had traveled all the way from places like China and Indonesia, and they're either carried overland all the way across the Silk Route, or they make their way around the coast of the Indian Ocean, after which they're picked up by the Venetians in ports like Alexandria or Beirut. And of course, the price was astronomically high by the time they reached Europe, which is of course why spices were such a prestigious item. Now let me mention how the Venetians held onto this monopoly, because it will set the pattern, or at least one pattern, for the future colonization around the world. The Venetians used galleys. Now picture a galley. It's this big rowed, flat-bottom ship. It can hold a lot of cargo, but of course spices and silk don't take up that much room. So the Venetians decided to arm these ships, and they filled them with guns to protect their trade. And they also captured a long stretch of coastland extending down the Dalmatian coast, Corfu in Greece, Crete, and Cyprus. Now, why would they do this? These served as stopping off points, so they don't have to be weighted down with supplies, and to provide friendly harbors in case they're chased by pirates or hostile Turks. And the Venetian state, fascinatingly, supported these enterprises. They ran the arsenal where the galleys were built. They maintained the outposts, and that's going to be a general pattern in years to come. State-sponsored trade. The Venetians built themselves this very nice maritime empire with colonies that are basically military garrisons. Now, the importance of this model is that it was imitated by the Portuguese. And Portugal's a little different. Remember, it faces the Atlantic, and galleys are not much use in the Atlantic Ocean. And that means that they were forced to develop a different kind of seaworthy vessel, and one that's mostly for fishing. And they did this. There's both the caravel that has the two lateen sails and a long keel, and later the galleon or the nau that has three masts and square rigging. And they also had to develop methods of navigation, far more sophisticated than used in the Mediterranean, where you can basically just hug the shore and hop from island to island. In the Atlantic, you have to venture far away from land, so they have to develop navigational charts, these port-to-land charts, crisscrossed with rum lines so that ships can follow them and use navigation. And they began to use equipment for navigation also, things like the astrolabe, a lot more effectively. And the Portuguese had a ruler, a prince, in the early 15th century. This is a person called Henry the Navigator, who founded a school of navigation and personally sponsored voyages. So again, here's the state backing. The assumption being that any profit made by merchants is ultimately wealth coming into the country. And if you resell what you bring in to other countries, that also is going to bring money in. And the whole idea is really to re-export these goods, not really buy from other nations, and that, of course, would cause money to flow out. Now, where were the Portuguese going? To start with, they were going down the coast of West Africa, where they found gold and ivory and rare woods, and if you recall, those grains of paradise, the Melaguita pepper, and of course, eventually slaves too. And the slaves were used mostly as household servants by nobles, but they're just beginning to be used on sugar plantations, on islands like Madeira and the Cape Verde Islands and eventually the Azores. And really, those are the only European possessions where you can grow sugar really profitably. And apart from that, most Europeans, of course, are still buying it from the Venetians. By the mid-15th century, they had taken 140,000 slaves in Guinea alone. And apparently, you could trade one horse for about 25 Africans and human. And they were traded. You know, they're not just grabbed. We have this image that people just showed up, grabbed people, and went away. They were traded for them. But in any case, the Europeans and sub-Saharan Africans are now directly connected. Now, the Portuguese never conquered these regions. They set up little armed trading posts, what they called a feitoria, which kind of means like a factory. And it's similar to what the Venetians have been doing. And the Portuguese kept heading south down the coast of Africa. But when they pass the equator, the currents flow in the opposite direction, counterclockwise. So they couldn't hug the coast anymore. And it took this enormous leap of courage to go out into the middle of the southern Atlantic in order to be carried back to the southern part of Africa. And that's particularly dangerous. It's because if it's one thing to follow a certain latitude and run east-west, you can do that with the North Star. But they had no way to tell longitude. So going north to south is really a complete guess. But they finally do it with Bartolomeu Dias when he rounds the Cape of Good Hope in 1488, and they now know where Africa ends. It then began to occur to them that they could go up the other side of Africa and across the Indian Ocean. If they could do that, they could completely cut out the Venetian middlemen and even the Arab tradesmen in the Middle East. In other words, they could go directly to the source, to India and to Indonesia for spices. It takes them about 10 years to finally follow up on this idea. They send Vasco da Gama with a little flotilla of four ships to try it, and he succeeds. He makes it all the way to Calicut on the west coast. That's not Calcutta, it's the west coast of India, where he came in contact with Asian ships that had come from Malacca. So Europe is now connected with Asia directly. And within a decade, the Portuguese had conquered Calicut. They destroyed the rival Muslim fleets under Alfonso de Albuquerque. And they set up a military post in India. And they would soon thereafter take the port of Goa too. And that remains in Portuguese hands, as you might know, all the way up into the 20th century. And they didn't stop there by any means. They eventually take Malacca itself, which is on the Malay Peninsula. They take Macau in China. They got a foothold in Japan for a while until they were booted out eventually. But most importantly is they set up posts in Java, in Sumatra, through Indonesia and the Spice Islands. And that is exactly where, of course, the spices come from. And interestingly, on one of these voyages in 1500, under Cabral, that's heading out into the Atlantic to try and reach South Africa, they actually bump into South America, which is really why Brazil becomes a Portuguese possession too. And we'll see, it's absolutely key in this whole story of globalization. But the result of all this exploration and discovery is that Lisbon becomes the largest and the wealthiest port in Europe. And the Portuguese have, in fact, successfully cut out the Venetians, bringing not only more spices to Europe, but in such great quantities that in the short term, the price doesn't come down, but eventually it does. It takes about a century to really push out the competition, the Venetians. And then eventually that price comes down. So think, what effect do you suppose this has on the valuation of spices in the long run? We're talking about by the 17th century. Spices are no longer such a prestigious item. They actually go out of fashion in elite cooking because now everyone can eventually afford them. They're not such a big deal anymore. And of course, ordinary people do still use them, right? That's down the road. But let's return to the 15th century. At this time, the Portuguese are getting going. Their neighbors, the Spanish, casting a jealous eye over the border. But in fact, they're pretty preoccupied themselves. The ruling couple, Ferdinand and Isabella, decide that they wanted their new joint kingdom, remember it's Castile and Aragon, pushed together, they want it to be completely Catholic. And to that end, they sought a complete reconquista. They wanted to get rid of the last Muslim province on the Iberian Peninsula, that's Granada. And B, they want to expel all Jews from the kingdom. Now, while they're busy with those plans, this Genoese merchant shows up with a great idea. The idea is to sail westward, go all the way around the globe, and reach Asia to pick up the same spices which the Portuguese are about to get. In fact, they hadn't quite yet. And actually, Columbus, which makes sense, took this idea to the Portuguese first. They laughed at him and they said, look, we're already on our way. We found a route. We know where we're going. We're going to go around Africa and directly to Indonesia, the East Indies. And Columbus actually had a good deal of experience with spices. He'd been on voyages to Chios for mastic, remember that gum that comes from the lentis tree? He'd been to Madeira for sugar. And apparently he even went on a fishing voyage all the way to Iceland. So he knew what he was talking about. He had great navigational techniques, most of which he learned in Portugal, interestingly enough. It's also interesting that he learned to write while he was in Portugal. And the thing is, Genoese isn't really a written language. It's a dialect of Italian. And he never really learned Tuscan, which is why he later spelled Spanish with odd Portuguese spellings. It's putting a sort of mystery over his real origins. Anyway, his plan did not appeal to the Portuguese, or to the English king Henry VII, who had his own plans, or the French. So he finally ends up going to Spain, kind of as a last-ditch effort. And he brings his ideas to Queen Isabella. She sort of wore the pants in that family. And contrary to the nonsense you may have been taught about Queen Isabella's advisors, they did not think the world was flat. In fact, no one does by this point. And in fact, anyone with even the slightest geographical knowledge knew that the world was round. Why they didn't support Columbus is because they didn't think he could make it all the way around. Columbus guessed it would be about 2,400 nautical miles. It's actually about 10,000. Okay, but the irony is that a little more than 2,400 miles brings you right to the Caribbean if you follow the latitude around from the Canaries. So that's just sort of weird. But at the same time Columbus presented the idea, the Spanish were totally preoccupied with their reconquest. So what changed their minds? Well, suddenly they get the news of Bartolomeu Dias rounding the Cape of Good Hope and the possibility of being completely overshadowed by their small neighbor, and the fact that some backers came forward at the last minute, Luis de Santangel, who was a converso Jew. But anyway, as you know, 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, but it was not until Granada fell and after the Jews were expelled. Both of those also happened, 1492. When he sets out, it's three very small ships. He hits 28 degrees latitude, at the level of Cape Verde Islands, and he goes straight across. And very quickly, October 12th, sets foot on a small island in the Caribbean. We don't know exactly which one it was, probably San Salvador or Watling's Island. And Columbus is overjoyed. They have finally reached Asia. Yes, despite three further voyages, Columbus was convinced until his dying day that he had discovered islands immediately adjacent to Cipangu, Japan, and China. And keep in mind, why he went was really to find spices, gold, maybe to convert some natives along the way, which was easy enough to do among the Arawak, not, as it turns out, among the more fierce Caribs. Of course, that word Carib is cognate with the word cannibal. That's where we get that word from. But it is absolutely clear from Columbus's logbook that he was desperate to find spices. And he keeps, in fact, misidentifying plants. He says, oh, look over here. There's cinnamon. That's got to be it. And here's a kind of nutmeg. And of course, he's completely mistaken. Can you think of the only botanical spice that's discovered in this area? It's allspice. That's native to Jamaica. It doesn't really become an important item in world trade. And even today, it's traded, but it's not worth a lot. But Columbus was nonetheless the first person from Europe to taste corn and tomatoes and chilies and sweet potatoes. He even got a taste of smoking tobacco. And all of these were grown on the islands that he discovered in the first voyage. And soon enough, more and more voyages start setting out. 1494 is a really fascinating date. Spain and Portugal figured, rather than have a squabble over who would take what in this period of exploration, they invited the Spanish Pope at the time, this is Alexander VI, the Borgia Pope, to preside over a treaty which takes place at Tordesillas. And it essentially divides the entire globe between the two powers. So everything east of a longitude 370 degrees west of Cape Verde belongs to Portugal, and that's Africa, Asia, the very tip of Brazil is given to them too. And everything to the west of that line, which is the South America, and ultimately it's the Philippines too, we'll see, That's given to Spain. And within a few years, the Spanish start settling in the New World. The pattern of colonization for them is very different from the Portuguese and their outposts. Realize the situations are completely different. The Portuguese were trading with a very advanced, populous regions, and there was no way on earth they were going to conquer them. The Spanish are thus far on little islands, and they have little trouble conquering them. And they begin handing out parcels of land to nobles, exactly as they had done in the reconquest of Spain from the Muslims. And the thing is that these noble warriors, it turns out, they don't really want to settle down and become farmers. They want to become wealthy. They want gold. They want to retire in luxury like nobles back in Spain. And in fact, they're granted what are called encomiendas, which is basically a grant to use the native people for labor, and eventually, ipso facto, the land goes with it. It's kind of, I think of it as a kind of adaptation of feudalism. In practice, it ends up being a lot more like slavery. But for some reason, this situation doesn't work out very well. And the reason is that the natives begin to die. And you know why it happens, is disease, measles, smallpox. The people there had never had previous contact with these diseases, or at least not since they had lived in Asia 10,000 years before. And the effect was absolutely devastating. Within a century or so, the Arawaks completely disappear off the face of the earth. And there are similar consequences on the mainland. In fact, by one estimate, the Valley of Mexico goes from a population of something like 25 million to down to one a century later. And there has been a long debate about how can a small group of Spaniards conquer a great civilization like the Aztecs? Well, yeah, they had horses, they had guns, but more than anything, they brought with them disease. And that's what gave the Spanish success. So let us get back to the Caribbean, where Columbus first landed, and also to Brazil. Without native populations to support the economy, eventually, there were laws passed, in fact, prohibiting enslavement of Native Americans. That's the work of Bartolomé de las Casas. And the colonists got this bright idea, well, if we can't make slaves of the Native Americans, let's import African slaves. Let's bring them to our plantations in the New World. And in fact, the reason that they don't get those same diseases is, remember, they're part of the same gene pool as Europe, this connection between Northern Africa and Europe. So now Africa and the Americas are directly linked, and they're primarily growing sugar, which, just like the spices, you know, within a century will become used in such great quantity that it also goes out of fashion, at least in European elite cooking. And I shouldn't say it goes out of fashion completely. It of course, is marginalized in desserts, but you don't see sweetness on main courses anymore. Of course, ordinary people, they can't get enough of it, and we'll see candy proliferates. But by the early 16th century, the Spanish had also discovered the mainland, and it's bizarre that credit goes to a Florentine named Amerigo Vespucci, basically because he had lied about an earlier voyage he made in 1504. In fact, Columbus was the first person to land on the mainland, but Vespucci, in a weird set of circumstances, wrote this letter back to his friend in Italy, Piero Soderini. This gets published, and somehow that letter gets into the hands of a mapmaker in Lorraine called Martin Waldseemüller, who sort of liked the idea of neat feminine names for all the continents, you know, this Africa and Asia. So he named this new place America. It's a complete accident of history, and oddly, a very undeserved honor, I should add. But without lingering on the details of the Spanish under Cortés, obviously they conquer the great Aztec Empire of Mexico, and then another man by mid-century, Francisco Pizarro, conquers the Inca Empire of Peru, in a sort of, you know, recapitulates the exact story in a weird way. And the Spanish eventually from there, especially from Acapulco, go across the Pacific. And by the 1570s, they found Manila in the Philippines also, which is important because, of course, the entire world is now linked economically. By this point, Magellan's crew had circumnavigated the whole globe as well. The only parts that aren't totally connected are North America and Australia, But there were voyages to North America. John Cabot, Italian, Giovanni Caboto is his original name, is sent by the English to Newfoundland, and he's exactly contemporary with Columbus. And then eventually the French send Cartier and Verrazzano, if you live in the Newark area, the bridge is named after him there. But why is all of this so important? Well, on one hand, Spanish introduced European plants and animals to the Americas. Okay, we have cattle, horses, pigs. In fact, they even just let pigs loose on the islands to reproduce. Chickens, wheat is introduced, and all the European fruits and vegetables, many of which go rampant and displace the native fauna. And just to give you an example of how destructive this process could be, think of dandelions. They come to this continent by accident. So do carrots. We recognize those as Queen Anne's lace. That's a wild carrot. And this is a process described by Alfred Crosby in a book called Ecological Imperialism. I think it's a great term to describe this. And yes, indeed, the people conquered, but so did the germs. So did the plants and animals. And they completely upset the local ecosystem. In fact, many species go extinct. And remember, in many cases, these plants and animals, when they arrive, have no natural predators. So they just reproduce like mad. Think about this. The grasses that you find all across North America, they're all imported from Europe. And of course, the Columbian exchange went both ways. For the first time in human history, plants native to all five separate continents are jumbled together, transplanted, mixed up, and it completely changes eating habits practically everywhere on Earth. For example, the sweet potato is introduced to the Philippines by the Spanish in the 16th century. In fact, there are some people who argue that it was brought across the Pacific to Polynesia even earlier. But in either case, eventually the sweet potato makes its way to China in 1593. And commissioners were sent to Luzon, in fact, especially in the Philippines, to help with a famine, and they came back with this sweet potato. And it turns out they're very easy to plant, they grow rapidly, and some historians suggest that the rapid and economically disastrous population growth of China happens right after that date, right after the sweet potatoes are introduced. In other words, resources that hadn't been there before suddenly cause population to rise too much. And what is ironic, though, is that Europeans were usually the slowest to adopt these new foods. So let me give you an example. Chili peppers. The Portuguese pick them up, little, you know, fiery red ones, and they decide that they don't want to sell them in Europe because that's going to compete with their trade in real pepper that they're bringing from India. So they ban it. They ban the trade. And a little bit gets planted in Europe, sort of as a botanical curiosity, but it doesn't become an important part of the cuisine until much later, or arguably some people say even until now, maybe. But they have no qualms bringing it elsewhere around the world. You know, that just brings money into the country. You know, they're not selling pepper all around the world, just in Europe. So if it causes competition, they weren't so concerned. So who do they bring it to? They bring chili peppers to the Turks. And within the first decades of the 16th century, it's found all throughout the Ottoman Empire. They're growing it in what's now Hungary. Think about paprikash, right? It becomes one of the most important spices in that cuisine. They bring it to India, their outposts there. And of course, the Indians go berserk over this. And it's, you know, such a lovely, spicy flavor. And ironically, the first botanical description of peppers in Europe, that's by Leonard Fuchs, who in 1542 says, peppers, chili peppers come from India. They bring them to Indonesia. They bring them to Southeast Asia and China. I mean, and imagine Sichuan cuisine before chili peppers, right? All that happens because the Portuguese bring them. They spread so rapidly for a few reasons. And one is that peppers are very easy to grow. They don't have specific light requirements. And they provide heat for practically no money. So for poor people, from the Middle East through to China, this becomes a replacement for expensive spices. And incidentally, I should mention Africa too, of course. They're adopted there and they become a basic, you know, part of the whole cuisine. But ironically, again, not Europe for quite a long time. In fact, the first printed recipe is the very end of the 17th century. And it's clear that the people who ate them in Europe are generally poor people. The story of tomatoes is similar, at least the fact that they didn't catch on in Europe for a long time. It seems that poor Spanish people were using them in the 16th century, basically because they had nothing else to eat. But anyone who could afford to, you know, was warned you should really stay away from tomatoes. And they did. Now, why? I think it's because tomatoes don't really fit into any culinary niche in European cuisine. There's nothing like them, really. And in fact, the only thing that's similar is in the Solanaceae family. That's like belladonna. That's a poison. You know, it's the poison of choice in the Renaissance. So they can't really serve as a substitute for a European food, the way, say, a New World beans definitely immediately are adopted and replace the old ones. Another reason is that when dietary writers get a hold of tomatoes, they say, well, this is a watery vegetable. Of course, it's got to be cold and moist and excessively phlegmatic and probably poisonous. And they also associate them, understandably, with their distant relatives, the eggplants, also Solanaceae, which they decided a long time ago, very unhealthy food. So it's the combination of like not knowing what to do with it and being told not to eat it that causes the tomato not to be used in Europe really for a few hundred years after the discovery. The first recipes are in Antonio Latini's Lo Scalco alla Moderna, and it's a tomato salsa. But notice something important here. Almost all the New World foods, when they get to Europe, are used in completely different ways than among the Aztecs or the Inca. And maize is really the perfect example of this. They plant it in Spain and northern Italy, and at the same time in Turkey, which is, of course, why the English call it turkey corn. They think it comes from there. And just for the same reason they call the bird a turkey, right? Mistakenly. Maize is very easy to grow. It fills a niche formerly taken by other grains, so things like barley and millet, which would have been ground up and made into polenta, right? And they adopted almost everywhere polenta was eaten, they start using corn in place of it. I mean, even in Romania, if you think of Mamaliga, okay? But the Europeans never learned that trick of soaking the corn with lime. They never ground it and baked it into tortillas, which makes it, so they never, and of course they're never combining it with beans in the same way as a rule. So the result is a very serious vitamin B deficiency and pellagra. So the weird thing is new crops don't always have positive consequences, especially if the technology doesn't come with them. Another classic example of this fact is the fate of the potato. It comes originally from Peru, and for some reason was adopted in the British Isles, but not in other places. The French and Germans don't touch them really till the 18th century. But the Irish found that they grew very well in their soil. So the story goes, they couldn't be stolen like other crops because they're hidden in the ground. I don't know if that's true. But over the centuries, they started planting potatoes rather than other grains. And potatoes are, of course, nutritious. But if everyone depends on one crop, what happens if a disease suddenly hits? Well, then everyone ends up starving. And that's exactly what happens in the potato blight in the mid-19th century. And it's also, of course, why there are more Irish people in the United States today than there are in Ireland. Now, clearly, that happens way down the road. We're not near there in the course so far. But just realize the globalization of food has all sorts of unexpected consequences. Now, just to give you an idea of how many foods get jumbled around immediately, let's take a little fun quiz. Let's see if you can tell me where these foods originate. Think of sunflowers. You're thinking Van Gogh, maybe southern France. They're actually from North America, and they're the only major food to be used globally, along with Jerusalem artichokes. That's the topinambur. That's a relative. Peanuts. What comes to mind? Jimmy Carter, the South. Maybe you'd even think of Africa, right? They're actually from South America. They're brought to Africa by the Portuguese, and then the slaves bring them over to North America. Think of okra, gumbo. Louisiana probably pops in your mind. Those are also African. But now think, where are they eaten? Southeast Asia, the Americas, pretty much everywhere. Pineapple, that's a little harder. You think, oh, Hawaii, right? Maybe Polynesia. They're actually from Jamaica in the Caribbean. Columbus was actually the first to taste them, and they were brought back to Europe, but they do not ship well. So they really don't become a major export crop until you have refrigerated shipping, okay? Bananas. come from Southeast Asia and India, but obviously now they're grown all over the tropics, South America, think of banana republics. Here's a hard one, kola nuts. That's African also. So sesame. This one's really hard, macadamia nuts. Perhaps Hawaii? No, it's actually Australia. Barbecue, that is American, in fact. That's an Arawak term. But think further for a second about globalization. You know, coffee grown in Colombia, although it's from Ethiopia. Pigs grown in Iowa, cattle in Texas, asparagus in California. Or just think of all the places where wine grapes are grown. That's from the Caucasus, and now they're everywhere on Earth, you know, everywhere Christianity goes, certainly, California, Chile, South Africa. So 1492 marks not only the discovery of a new world for Europeans, but the discovery of the entire world by everyone.